now in session. The Honorable Stephen J. Dwyer presiding.
Want to be seated, please?
First up, State of Washington and Sampson.
Good morning. Nancy Collins here on behalf of Marcel Sampson. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just the first comment on the issue of the number of jurors who deliberated. It appears that the court reporter made an error in transcribing the polling, and there was no unauthorized person in the jury room.
We were really looking forward to trying to figure out how that happened.
I was puzzled by it, but the transcript appears to be erroneous. But there were, however, significant evidentiary errors in the case. The state's case relied to a significant degree, on testimony admitted under a statute that has since been declared unconstitutional by our Supreme Court. Because it is reasonably probable that this inadmissible evidence materially affected the outcome, the remedy is reversal of the convictions and remand for a new trial. The material effect of on the outcome of the case can be measured by several areas. First, there was substantial testimony about this inadmissible incident from the aunt of Ms. Porter herself, her mother, and the detective, who all talked about it in some detail. Ms. Porter came to trial as a 20-year-old. She was articulate, and she gave detailed and powerful evidence about this prior incident. And in fact, in the state's closing argument, the prosecutor mentioned this, that Ms. Porter is now an adult at 20. The prosecutor says, she came back to testify not through the cloud of childhood, but to tell you with precision how the defendant raped her, and then went on detail to describe those her testimony at trial. The instruction that the court gave did not limit the use of the evidence, which was permissible under the statute. That was a correct instruction at the time. But it simply said that the evidence of these prior sex offenses could not on its own be sufficient to prove Mr. Sampson guilty of these charged crimes. But that didn't in any way limit it. And in fact, instruction 8, the next instruction, said specifically certain evidence has been admitted only for a limited purpose, and then listed 4 pieces of evidence that could only be used by the jury for a limited purpose, highlighting the fact that instruction 7 had no limitations on its use.
Does this claim of error have any impact on the non-sex counts, the felony violation of a court order and the tampering
count? Well, yeah, it's obviously a far closer question on those, and we do believe that it does taint the trial to a significant degree to hear such highly prejudicial evidence about Mr. Sampson's character and appetite, that it does infect all the convictions. But on those specific convictions, obviously, it's a closer question.
Counsel, weren't there tape-recorded statements between the accused and someone, I can't recall who, in which he essentially admitted to having committed these charged crimes?
There was a discussion for the detective and Mr. Sampson where he admitted the prior incident with Ms. Porter. He didn't admit those then. And then there was a more ambiguous discussion, some recorded phone calls about, I admit that I could use treatment, DVNC treatment. But there was never any admissions in those prior statements by Mr. Sampson. The state's closing argument spent substantial time, and really the theme of the argument, you could say, was that Mr. Sampson had an appetite for committing these similar offenses, and that appetite is demonstrated first by the Ms. Porter incident, which carried on. But this is a propensity argument. It is not an argument. And the court specifically did not admit the evidence, the same evidence under 404B for a pattern, for a same common scheme or plan.
So unlike this isn't like Graham.
Right. Unlike the companion case in Gresham, the Scherner case, where the court had found admissible for both purposes and the prosecutor had made that argument, a permissible argument under ER 404B, that's not the case here, where it was not admitted as a common scheme or plan, but that was the argument that was presented to the jury, that it was that it showed a pattern, that it was an appetite, that it was a sort of a character, a type of person that Mr. Sampson was. And that's why, like the Gresham case, this court cannot say that it's not reasonably probable to have a material effect on the outcome. Because very much like the Gresham case, there was testimony from child complainants that was ambiguous and vague, and you know, there's not very articulate, and then there was an articulate person talking about something that happened years before, and that was the centerpiece of the argument and before the jury. There were, you know, some additional evidentiary errors that can also go to sort of the cumulative harm, the vouching for the truthfulness of the children and some child hearsay that shouldn't have been admitted, but also ways in favor of granting Mr. Sampson a new trial, where proper evidence, you know, certainly can be admitted, but under the rules of evidence and not under this unconstitutional statute. And if there are no remaining questions, I'll just reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Seaver. I'm appearing on behalf of the state of Washington. I'd first like to begin just by apologizing for not requesting the audio recording of the polling of the jury before submitting my brief. I regrettably assumed that it wasn't actually recorded, but was just a transcript that had been produced from a stenographer's notes. So I'd like to apologize for that. I don't have a great deal to say, but turning to the issue of the evidence related to Ms. Porter, just to be clear, the evidence was admitted on both bases, both under the 1058 statute and under evidence rule 404B, so it wasn't as if completely inadmissible evidence was introduced into this case based on the subsequent invalidation of the statute. It was also admitted to prove motive and intent.
But there was no instruction to the jury.
Regrettably, Your Honor, the limiting instruction listed a number of prior bad acts that should be considered under the standard evidence ER 404B instruction. For whatever reason, this particular incident was not listed in that instruction, but the court specifically admitted it.
It had been listed. Gresham hadn't been decided yet. It appears that the trial court followed the laws that existed at the time of trial, and that the rule book has changed.
Exactly, Your Honor. I think that's probably exactly what happened, but just to be clear, the state offered that evidence under both on both bases. And turning to Judge Cox, your question about the...
Let's get to that. If the only ruling had been under 404B, it comes in for motive or intent, and if the statute had never existed, under the case law prevailing prior to the statute's passage, would the defendant have been entitled to an instruction that would have precluded the prosecutor from five times referring to his appetite for children in argument?
The answer to that, there's kind of two parts to Your Honor's question. The first is whether he's entitled to a limiting instruction, and of course the...
He would have been before the statute.
Correct.
I mean, the argument was perfectly proper if the statute had been constitutional. Exactly. This argument was exactly what the legislature intended.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I should back off from that, Your Honor. The first question is whether the absence of a limiting instruction requires reversal, and I would submit that that's not what this court or the case law supports. This mere absence of the instruction necessitates reversal. It is subject to a harmless error analysis.
The opposing argument, the appetite argument, make reversal necessary.
I'm sorry.
The prosecutor, with a vengeance, argued that Mr. Sampson had an appetite for young children.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's why he should be convicted.
Your Honor.
Doesn't that sound like he should be convicted because of his character?
It was, with all due respect, I don't believe the prosecutor was making the argument that based on his interactions with the much older Ms. Porter when she was victimized, he evidenced an appetite for young children that required him to be convicted of the current charges without any consideration of the evidence underlying those current charges.
How would you characterize his use of the phrase appetite for young children and its intent?
The evidence in this case concerned the defendant's victimization of two young boys who were, I believe, 6 and maybe 3 years old. One of the boy's 8-year-old sisters, and an incident in which he displayed pornography to the 8-year-old girl and her 10-year-old cousin, and had also videotaped another young girl who had been showered surreptitiously.
The rebuttal argument, perfectly allowable under the statute, which would have made it not possible to obtain a limiting instruction precluding the argument, in the rebuttal argument, the prosecutor lists the various children in both the charged counts and uncharged incidences by name, and then says, what am I up to? Eight kids. Then he refers to the defendant, says he didn't have control over his appetite for kids. Is there any way that argument gets made if the statute had never been passed? Isn't that what this comes down to? Because if 404B can't save it, if you couldn't have argued the case that way under 404B.
And I guess where I struggle with the question, Your Honor, is that the argument was never made to the jury that the defendant's interactions solely with Ms. Porter suggest that he had an appetite for children that requires the jury to convict him on these current charges, because once in the past.
But it's the classic propensity argument. Believe the evidence presented on the charged crime because of the evidence of the past crimes.
And that's the argument.
Showing that he doesn't have control over his ability to commit these types of acts.
That's, I guess, as best as I can phrase it, Your Honor, that's, there are two ways to look at the argument. The first is, because of the episodes with Ms. Porter, the defendant had an appetite for children. The other is, look at all of the evidence in the current charges, plus he has this prior bad act with Ms. Porter that showed his motive and intent when it came to victimizing much younger children, and it's clear that once you look at all of the evidence in the case, the defendant has an appetite for children. I'm not defending necessarily the choice of the word appetite, but what I am suggesting, Your Honor, is that the deputy prosecutor was fairly careful in suggesting that Ms. Porter's episode was not a sign of propensity so much as it had been also offered as proof of motive and intent. The court may disagree, but that is my reading of the closing argument, both the opening and rebuttal arguments, that it was that the prosecutor did not run too far afield with the allowance granted him under 1058 before it had been invalidated, that this wasn't a convict him of these crimes because he had committed this crime in the past, and I think that's really the harm. And the other thing to consider in terms of harmless error analysis is that the defendant himself was not convicted. The jury hung on a number of charges, three counts of rape of a child in the first degree, one of which was the victim of a charge for which the defendant was convicted. So to suggest that this was so inflammatory that it improperly swayed the jury, I think has to be seen in light of the fact that the jury was unable to reach a verdict on a number of serious counts that are so closely related to the charges, to some of the charges he was convicted of, suggests that perhaps this wasn't, the jury didn't see it as quite as inflammatory as Ms. Collins and her client suggest on appeal.
Or that he appeared to be such a dangerous person that they had to find at least one thing in this trial with all of this conflicting evidence to hang on him.
I guess I would challenge or deny the assertion that it was conflicting evidence.
Both of our contentions would adhere in the verdict, and we wouldn't be able to know the answer.
That's absolutely true. Right. But I think, you know, obviously when the court's assessing harmless error and has to decide whether this particular admission of this evidence under this now invalidated rule materially affected the outcome, the fact that the jury didn't convict on everything, I think, is something the court can't take into account. With regard to the other issues, I would rest on the state's brief unless the court has any other questions. I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just wanted to note that towards the beginning of the prosecutor's closing argument on page 51, he says, let's start with the Ms. Porter incident, and then he says, this shows the defendant's appetite, his appetite for, frankly, children. That was the start. That was the backdrop you saw in Ms. Porter, emphasizing that she was a slight young woman who actually looked younger than her years. And with that, I don't have any further comments unless the court has any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.